Welcome to Savor Food and Body, a podcast for women in midlife who are ready to lose the mental and emotional weight of dieting. I'm your host, Amanda Bullitt, an undieting dietitian and certified intuitive eating counselor. Join me as I talk with other experts in the fields of intuitive eating, women's health, body image, and so much more. You'll also hear stories of women just like you who have learned to undiet their lives and fully embrace wellness without obsession. Let's get started. Welcome back to another episode of the Savor Food and Body podcast, and Happy New Year. We are starting into, it's January. It is also known as National Dieting Month to those of us that have worked in the food and wellness space, and myself in grocery retail for almost a decade of my career. And we always knew when we were getting ready for January, because all of the displays shifted over to helping people with their health and oftentimes weight loss goals in January. But I am talking today with Dr. Michelle May, and we are going to flip that whole National Dieting Month idea on its head and talk more about how could January instead be your time to start undieting your life. Dr. May has been on the podcast before. We'll link to her previous episodes. You can learn more about her work there. But today we both just wanted to talk about why is it important to consider undieting your life in January and how you might be able to do that when the noise of diet culture is so loud. The volume is super turned up in January. So Dr. May, Michelle, thank you so much for being here again. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always. So why don't you give us a little bit of background for listeners that are new to the show? Tell us who you are, what you do, and what you bring to this mindful eating space.
Thanks, Amanda. Well, I'm a family physician by training. I practiced for 16 years. And overlapping with that, and for the last 25 years, I have been the CEO of Am I Hungry Mindful Eating Programs and Training, which basically means that we develop mindful eating programs to help people break their eat, repent, repeat cycle. And we also train other health and wellness professionals to offer programs and coaching and therapy in their practices and their community. I also wrote a book series called Eat What You Love, Love What You Eat. Probably the epitome of undieting is eating what you love. And so I love this topic like you do, and love to really inspire people to be thinking a little bit differently about what it takes to be well and how to make changes that truly last.
You know, when listening to your story and kind of the timeline of things, not to get ageist here, but you're kind of one of the grandmothers, really, of this whole movement. I mean, yeah, you're not old enough to be a true grandmother in the sense of that way. But, you know, when you're thinking about 25 years, I mean, intuitive eating in and of itself as a model is about that age as well. So yeah, you've been working in this space just as long as Evelyn Tribbley and Elise Rasch, and you guys have really all been kind of forerunners of this work and bringing this different perspective of looking at food and body image to the world for people, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because I think we were working on our work around the same time frame. We certainly weren't aware of each other. And I have to acknowledge that even decades before that, there have been people who have been writing about the failure of diets and the promotion of thinness as a form of social injustice to women and people of color. So this kind of conversation has actually been going on for a very long time, which to you and me is a little discouraging because it's hard to be heard above the noise, the marketing that's promoting weight loss and restrictive eating and behaviors that really are not only unsustainable but harmful. And you know, it's challenging for people to sort of get it. And so that's why I love having a conversation like this.
Yeah, you know, I love the word undiet because I've worked in this space long enough. You have used the language of non-diet and anti-diet and all of that, of which we're all kind of saying the same thing. But what I love about the word undiet, one, it doesn't feel quite as forceful, which if someone is just being introduced to these topics and this way of looking at food in their bodies,
that could be kind of a turnoff if it feels so like anti and radical, because they do maybe still want to lose weight. And they're kind of sorting themselves out around that. And with undieting, I think about it as just taking this ball of yarn and just starting to pull it and unravel it and pull apart the messages, the beliefs around food, the food rules, which I don't know if you see this in your practice or with your group programs, but definitely in my practice, sometimes people don't even know what they have wound up in their ball as being an influence from diet culture. And so a lot of times as we delve into what is their food story, what is their body story, and we start pulling that yarn from that ball, we start to uncover those messages that they didn't even really think of as dieting or diet mentality, but it's still, those messages are still holding them back from having a fully peaceful relationship with food in their body, experiencing food freedom and food joy.
Yeah, that's really beautifully said, Amanda, because, you know, we're all swimming in diet culture and we don't even recognize it for what it is. I think one of the things that I see all the time is that people assume that it's normal to start a diet in early January, and we all hear all the data about how often people are through with their resolutions within just a few weeks. And that has kind of become the expected course of events. And so people don't even recognize that what they're doing is actually a form of disordered eating, that it doesn't have to be that way, that in fact, what we really can do with people is help them not only identify the dieting belief systems that have wormed their way into their brains and are keeping them stuck, but also to replace those with thoughts and beliefs and behaviors that are actually far more effective, way more fun, and a lot more sustainable, because you don't stop and start it. You practice it. It does take a learning curve. It does take oftentimes a coach like you or me to help people to get through that process. But eventually, they don't need us anymore. And that's what I love, because I really want people to become their own expert.
Yeah, same. I couldn't agree more. And just, you know, for listeners to kind of put something in perspective here, I love how you said, you know, oftentimes people are starting a new program, they're all excited about it, they're probably doing it with their friends. I don't know how many times my clients have done Whole 30, the month of January, and there's some camaraderie around that. But coming out of the grocery retail industry, we knew through retail science, you might say, that people break their diets Super Bowl Sunday, and it's all over Super Bowl Sunday. Like there's data that shows, like, this is why, and people can go into wherever their local supermarket is and watch that play out this year. Yeah. And that's why all of the displays change over getting ready for Super Bowl Sunday. Now we see chips front and center, and we see the guacamole, and we see the three-layer bean dip and all of this. And so there is, I mean, yes, there's a science to that, but it's a science based on human behavior.
Right. Well, so, and it also is very, it's the epitome of what we're talking about here, because to me, one of the overarching reasons that the whole system has failed us all, and by the way, it's failed us. We didn't fail. That's a big myth. As a previous chronic yo-yo dieter, I thought I was a failure. I just thought I had no willpower, even though I'd been to medical school. There was a disconnect there, right? And, or maybe that I just hadn't found the right diet, or I needed to try again or try harder. The real underlying issue, though, is this extreme thinking. So we've got New Year's, well, we came out of the holidays. People were eating the foods that they love, the ones they miss, the ones that they celebrate with. And there's nothing wrong with that. The challenge is that because they have the belief system that they've blown it and they might as well enjoy it because they know January 2nd is coming and it's going to be all over again. So then they go back on their diet or start something new. And that in and of itself is also not sustainable and doesn't feel great and is hard to do long term. And then comes Super Bowl Sunday, where we have completely the opposite behaviors. What I really want people to understand is that when you are using the skills that we teach in mindful eating, and specifically in the Am I Hungry program, there is no on and off a diet. You eat the way you make decisions every single day, and what your decisions are might change a bit depending on the circumstances and what you're in the mood for, but you're not doing anything different. You're not on or off a plan anymore.
That's really important for people to hear. And I often talk about it in my practice as, you know, one of the principles of intuitive eating is permission, practicing full permission with all foods. But there's a nuance to that permission in that full permission means there's no conditions around it. It's like unconditional love. So that full permission doesn't mean like, okay, you get full permission to eat all your favorite foods during the holidays because January's coming right around the corner. And it doesn't mean that we get to Super Bowl Sunday and, oh, you've been doing so good for the last 4 to 6 weeks. You have permission to eat what you want during game time because you're going to get back on track on Monday. That's not full permission. And so I think sometimes when people are starting and maybe they've heard about intuitive eating or mindful eating and they're ready to start exploring these two concepts, they can get tripped up in this permission place. And oftentimes I find that's where some more of that unraveling needs to happen. And those conversations happen around, well, what's truly full permission and what's conditional permission? And what beliefs do they have around that? What scenarios have come up in their life? And so many people do this. I mean, everybody's doing it. We're recording this during the holiday season, and everybody's doing that right now. I'm hearing it right and left. I'm seeing it right and left too. Oh, I've got the condition. I've got the permission to eat the holiday cookies and this and that, and I can get as many as I want because I know January's coming too. So I think that that's another layer to all of this too, is exploring that idea of permission and true full permission. Like you said, there's no on again or off again.
Right.
It's just eating what your body is hungry for and what seems satisfying, and honoring just those basic needs and cues.
Yeah. And I think the challenge, of course, though, that we have to acknowledge is that for people who've been stuck in what I call the eat, repent, repeat cycle for years, most of the time decades, by the time they come to me to get some help, you know, it's a very scary idea to eat what they love. It's really scary because in their experience, when they let off on the rules, they lost control or felt out of control. And what they don't realize, it's the rules themselves that were creating this feeling of restriction and deprivation and cravings, and then the feeling of giving in and saying, oh, what the heck, I'm going to, you know, I won't be able to stop. And then I'll stop when I go on my new diet. And when we're completely turning the whole paradigm upside down, and truly getting rid of the rules and dealing with unconditional permission to eat what you love, what actually happens, which is totally counterintuitive, is that food loses its power over you. You'll make mistakes. You will sometimes eat more than you really need and will feel uncomfortable, maybe regretful afterward, but you can learn from mistakes. With dieting, when you've blown it, it's punitive. You failed. You have to start over again. And that's not the way it is with this process. It's a very different way to approach your eating.
I'm curious, in your timeline of doing this work, how have you seen people's relationship with food and their bodies change over the years, whether that's different diets they're on, different mindsets they're on? How have you seen it change, if at all? Or is it the same story that we go through every year?
It's the same wolf in different sheep's clothing is what it is. Because what I've seen, well, first of all, I've gone on my own journey. You know, I didn't start out in this work being completely weight neutral. I didn't focus on weight loss, but I didn't really understand the harm that it had caused me and many of my patients and clients. So that's one big shift, is that I personally and many of my colleagues have become weight neutral or weight inclusive. Not enough of them, but we're working in that direction. But in terms of our patients, you know, the camp is sort of split. There's the whole group of people who are now seeking weight loss perhaps more than ever because of the emphasis and the fear mongering around health problems, which, you know, that's not what the topic of this conversation is about, but, you know, it is fear mongering. And really there's a whole other way to approach our health rather than trying to change the size or shape of our bodies. The other thing I see, though, is that a lot of people are starting to recognize the futility of weight cycling and yo-yo dieting and restrictive eating and disordered eating. They're really starting to acknowledge that the pain that they feel from that process is not their fault, and that diets themselves are destined to fail, and that there has to be a better way to do this. Social media has had a big impact on both of these, right? Like the, you know, all the before and after pictures and all the, you know, the photoshopped or the filtered images that people are exposed to tends to drive more of that body consciousness. And there's also people like yourself who are doing such a great job of helping to enlighten people about the fact that it doesn't have to be that way.
I love how you said people are recognizing, and I think this to be true, in that diets don't work. People are starting to recognize that. However, and I'm going to throw a little bit of a wrench into this conversation because I'm just so curious to hear your perspective on this. Now we have these weight loss drugs that have entered the scene in a pretty big way in the last year, year and a half. I'm talking about Ozempic. I'm talking about Wegovy, the GLP-1 drugs that they've been around for a while, more than a while, for people with diabetes having a medical need for those drugs. But now we have this weight loss perspective around those drugs. And so what I'm noticing in the media and social media is that maybe these same folks, particularly women in midlife, I'm seeing a number of articles that are coming out putting perimenopause weight gain and Ozempic in the same article. And so again, these people have probably for decades, they've been on that on again, off again diet roller coaster. They know that it doesn't work. They know that it's punitive. So now they're seeing all this message and like, oh, what if I just go get this pill? And now I don't have to diet. And I magically get to lose this weight. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, it's a mixed bag, even for myself, because I have clients that are taking it for blood sugar management. I understand the medical needs. So I'm just really curious to hear your perspective, too.
Well, I think part of the reason we struggle with a clear answer on this is they are relatively new. I mean, having this many people on them and basically the manufacturers themselves admit that as soon as you go off the drug, you regain the weight. So the question I would ask is, are you really willing to commit yourself to taking an injection once a week, as far as we know, for the rest of your life, and in some cases at really high cost if your insurance isn't covering it for diabetes or some other condition, which, you know, that's the jury's still out on that as well. And we don't really know the long-term side effects. We don't know yet whether they will even be effective long-term. We know with bariatric surgery that, you know, of course, is still very, very popular, but the vast majority of people start a process of weight regain after a period of time. We don't know what we're going to see with these medications. To me, what's really interesting about it, though, is that it just shows how much people are willing to spend a lot of money and take something that's largely new and begin to use it for weight loss, because weight loss seems to be the panacea that people are seeking. So that's the question I have for people is, okay, you know, if we're seeking health, if you're seeking to live a better life, let's look at the bigger picture. And I too have clients who are taking the medications, and I'm happy to work with them because they're dedicated to changing their lifestyle, changing their relationship with food, unraveling that ball of diet mentality that you were referring to. They're doing the behind the scenes work. I just worry so much about people who are thinking that this is going to be some quick fix and then their problems are going to be over and they'll never have to deal with this issue again, because we don't know that's actually what's going to happen here. Yeah, what do you think?
I'm in the same boat. I'm just, as I always say to my clients, compassionate curiosity is kind of the mantra that I lead by. And whether that's with them and their own food and body experiences, or looking at this whole GLP-1 drug scene in general, I can have a lot of compassion for why people want to be taking it, particularly women in midlife that are bumping up against perimenopause weight gain and going, what the hell? This, whose body is this? I don't recognize this. And the distress that comes with that.
Wait a minute. You're making me think that we need to have this conversation. So perimenopausal weight gain is very common. We could even consider it normal because of the changes that occur hormonally. So that's what I meant before when I was saying that, you know, it causes us to sort of reflect on our approach. So if that is a normal process of aging and hormonal change, why can we not embrace that this is what bodies do? Bodies are constantly changing, instead of having to bump up against this and say, oh no, this shouldn't be happening. Something is wrong with me. I don't look like I did before. Well, yeah, honestly, most of us don't look like we did when we were 18 either, right? So I think it just gives us an opportunity to explore this larger issue of pressure on people, women in particular, to maintain some thin ideal. And I don't know, the biases that occur when people are outside of that range.
Right. And it's not just the weight gain, it's the aging process too. Because to your point, which I agree 100%, and why we do so much work in this season of life around body acceptance and body awareness, is to be aware that these changes are happening in our body and learn to find some compassion, find some acceptance with it. Again, that compassionate curiosity, getting curious about what's going on with our bodies and why these changes are happening. And that's what gets my hackles up when I see a women's health article or something that is interviewing a woman in perimenopause who was freaked out about not accepting her body changing, the weight coming on as a natural part of going through the perimenopause experience and reaching out for this weight loss drug. I can also have compassion for her too, and that's distressing. Her lived experience is distressing, again, because the problem is not hers. The problem is a cultural problem. Because the problem is saying you better not gain weight. And if you're gaining weight and you're getting old at the same time, well, you are going to be obsolete big time.
Right. Well, and then I'm imagining that some of our listeners here are also thinking, yes, but what about health? What about health? And I will insert here that, as I mentioned before, I now practice and teach from a weight neutral and weight inclusive perspective. Because I've read hundreds and hundreds of articles on this topic. And the thing is that health and weight are correlated or associated in many conditions, but one does not necessarily cause the other. Sometimes the relationship might be the exact opposite, that the condition itself may be causing changes in body size. What we do know, though, is that our behaviors, in other words, the amount that we exercise, having a great support system, whether you smoke or not, you know, how you eat, and also difficult to change is the zip code you live in, your social determinants of health. So there are many, many other factors that you are in charge of that may or may not affect your body size, but could absolutely improve your overall well-being. And I think sometimes we get distracted with weight loss as the goal or the resolution, and we lose focus on creating sustainable behaviors that actually feel good and feel better the longer that you practice them, unlike dieting, which just gets harder and harder and harder over time.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And that's really what you're speaking to, is kind of like part of that foundation of undieting too. Because when we remove that intentional weight loss piece of dieting, then it's exposing our minds, it's dedicating our energy, it's opening up our energy to have capacity to go focus on those bigger picture pieces of health, whether that's other behaviors, trying to get better sleep, trying to get more sleep, trying to have less screen time, trying to go for a walk or some sort of joyful movement. And so when we remove that focus on the number on the scale, then our brains just have more capacity to explore these other determinants of health and how we might be able to help ourselves in other capacities that we may not have thought about before. And along those lines, I'm curious with, you mentioned the top of our conversation, you know, the programs that you run and how you help people do their version of undieting in your programs too. And you're putting a new facelift, some new spins, you're updating your program because you've been running it for many years now. And so as we go into the new year, I'm curious if you could give us just a few, you know, tips that you've either taught in the past or you will be teaching in as you go move into the new year of how to help people remove that intention from the intentional weight loss and start to think about, how do I think of this big picture version of health? And how do I think just beyond the scale for health?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, I would like to say that it's super easy. Just do this and you'll be fine. I mean, the challenge, of course, for us is that we're swimming in diet culture, and many, many people that we can help the most have been dieting most of their adult life. And if not, in my case, I started when I was 12. So I find that story very, very, very commonly, that people have been dieting since a very young age. So I've begun to think, I haven't changed the process that I use. As you know, I developed something called the mindful eating cycle, which is 6 decision points that really touch on all the decisions that we make regarding eating. That has proven over the last 25 years to be a game changer for my clients. So when they are able to learn those 6 decision points, they truly gain so much insight into what they're doing, and they gain the ability to make those decisions for themselves without ever having to weigh, measure, or count food, or look something up, or log it into an app. So that hasn't changed at all. However, I have begun to think about the work that I do, and I'm assuming you as well, that it really occurs in 3 stages of transformation. So the first stage, and sometimes these will overlap, but just for clarity, these stages of transformation is 1, to learn to listen to and trust your body wisdom, to break free of the overeating cycle that people often get trapped in. So stage 1 is to listen to your body wisdom. So for you and I, our work will revolve around helping people re-engage with identifying hunger cues. What are they? What causes them? Identifying how hungry they are, how full they are when they eat, and using this inside out information to help them with decisions. So they don't need a portion size chart. They always know how to make the decisions for themselves. So there's a little bit more involved in that, but that's stage of transformation 1. 2 is fearless eating. This is to break up with dieting. It's to break up with rules about good food and bad food. It's to literally begin to see foods as simply choices that they make that have effects. And so when we begin to think of food in terms of, okay, if I eat this food, I feel better. If I eat too much of that food, I feel worse. Okay, now I'm gaining information here that I can use to help me with my decisions. It really, in my experience, helps people break that I've already blown it, I might as well keep eating cycle, where they end up then binging on things that they consider to be their problem foods. And really, once you can eat what you love freely, as we talked about before, food loses its power over you. And then the third stage of transformation, and this is the most difficult one. The other two are really important in order to set the groundwork for this third stage. And that is to begin to recognize why you're eating or wanting to eat when you don't need food or when you don't need any more food. Because therein often lies some of the underlying emotional triggers or food associations or connections that people have made that oftentimes they blame on the food, holiday treats, for example, when in fact it's what they're seeking by eating that food, you know, whether it's something to do or relief from stress or distraction or calming or energizing. I mean, there's all kinds of reasons that people do these things. So this process for us is about helping people recognize the role of emotions, why we have emotions in the first place, beginning to speak in the language or vocabulary of emotions. So we begin to get really clear about what our body is trying to tell us. And then most importantly, how to meet those needs even better than food ever could without all the strings attached of trying to use food to meet those needs. So that part of this is one huge door opener, because once people begin to become able to interpret how their emotions are communicating with them, they become so much more able to meet their needs better. And once food's out of the way, they can just forge ahead and live that big, vibrant life they've been craving and that they thought that next diet would give them.
I'm a big fan of roadmaps, helping people connect the dots. And I love that idea of those three stages and then breaking those down even further into those six pillars, principles. I forget the word that you used for that.
Well, they're decision points, but yes,
decision
exactly.
Points. Yes, mm-hmm. I love that. Mm-hmm. And so, and those, I see those as maybe kind of your guideposts along this bigger picture map that you're guiding people through, which I think is so helpful, because when we've come out of years of dieting and following food rules, there's a prescription that people follow. And oftentimes my clients will say, because I'll ask them, what was the best part about dieting? What was the best part? What was the worst part? Like, let's get clear on that so that we can try to create a bridge from what you were doing with dieting to over here with eating with more attunement and freedom. And yeah, it can kind of feel willy-nilly and scary to your point earlier too. So how do we create a bridge between those? And so having a framework just like you're talking about, or a map, a way for people to connect the dots to help them get from dieting to undieting, I think is so helpful.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think because, you know, it's something we all knew how to do intuitively when we were born. I mean, we knew how to eat when we were hungry and stop when we were full. And we didn't, you know, we didn't intentionally choose diet foods or foods we didn't even like. I mean, that was not part of our nature. Those are learned behaviors. And those behaviors can be unlearned as well. Once we have, you know, once we've learned how to manage our eating with dieting, we can unlearn those behaviors too. It's just that people need new skills and tools. We can't just say, don't diet, or, you know, sometimes people will hear an episode like this and think, oh, okay, so I'm just going to, you know, like you said, eat whatever I want and I don't diet again. And then they feel lost and it didn't work and they feel overwhelmed, because there really are some specific skills and tools that you need to relearn. And that's why you and I do the work that we do, I think.
100%. It's what makes this work really rewarding too, to help somebody connect their own dots. Michelle, where would you like to send people to learn more about the new upcoming things you have going on in the new year and what you've got going on to support people on dieting their lives?
Thank you for asking. Well, my website is amihungry.com, and that's always a great place to get free articles and blog posts. You can take an eating style quiz there or download the first chapter of my book, all of that on the homepage. So amihungry.com. I am also doing a free masterclass for the beginning of this new year called the Anti-Resolution Plan, How to Eat with Ease, which will really lay out these three stages of transformation. So if people are curious about, you know, how would this work? Could it work for me? That would be a great class to attend. It's free. It'll be 90 minutes. You can find that on amihungry.com/anti-resolution plan, all one word, anti-resolution plan. And you can register for that free masterclass and learn more about it for yourself.
That could be a great resolution right there. Just signing up to learn from you, get to hang out with you for 90 minutes and learn from all of your wisdom. Can't go wrong there. So we'll put links to all of that in the show notes so people will know where to find you. And thank you again for coming to be on the podcast. It's always a pleasure to catch up with you and get your perspective. And we didn't talk about the Ozempic part last time. So I was so thankful for you to share your wisdom with that. That was really cool.
It's probably an evolving field. We'll have many conversations as it plays out, but I think at least now we have to use our compassionate curiosity to think about these issues and many, many others.
Absolutely. We'll talk to you again soon, Michelle. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Amanda.
Thanks for listening today. I hope this conversation inspires you to undiet your life and start savoring food and your body. You can find show notes and resources from this episode by going to alpinenutrition.org/blog, B-L-O-G. If you'd like to learn more about my one-on-one counseling or group coaching programs, go to my website, alpinenutrition.org, and click Work With Me at the top of the page. And finally, if you found this episode helpful, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show. Until next time, keep savoring food and your body.